Hi and welcome. This is January the 12th. I have two stories that we're going to be going through today. We're going to start with one appropriate to the day having to do with my father. January 12th is celebrated in our house for at least 30 years as being Hermann Göring Day. If you're not aware of who Hermann Göring was, he was the fellow who was head of the Nazi Air Force back in World War II. He was a corpulent, drug-addled Nazi who basically cheated the hangman after the war, hung himself just prior to his scheduled demise at the firing squad. He was a number two Nazi at one point or another. His birthday just happened to fall on January the 12th, which is the same as my father's. Today would have been my father's 94th birthday. Hermann Göring, well, he's been gone for a little bit. Also of note today, Howard Stern, the radio personality, his birthday is on January 12th. He'll be 63 today. And another corpulent or formerly corpulent person of note, Rush Limbaugh, also celebrates his birthday on January the 12th. Though some have gone and drawn parallels between Limbaugh and the ex-Nazi that we celebrated as my father's birthday. Dad has been gone since, he was 72 when he died, so this has been about 22 years since he's been gone. Miss him terribly, but he'll sort of live on through some of the stuff that he wrote. One something I will say here, and this is the prelude to the story I'm about to read. It's called Death in Llewellyn. My father was never one for convention. Some may have seen him as being at least a little bit eccentric. I will posit that he was one of a kind, just like the protagonist in this story that's coming up. As best as I can tell, my father wrote Death in Llewellyn sometime in the late 40s to early 50s, maybe as a class assignment. I didn't see the story until 2014, when it was forwarded to me by a cousin who was cleaning up bits and pieces of her mother's, my father's sister's, belongings. I had heard that my father had either written or was in the process of writing stories mostly for his own amusement. The inclusion of Death in Llewellyn in the collection, this is the coin jar by the way, was one which is a no-brainer to me. It captures some of the heart and soul of my father, even from the title. There are some glitches in the story which drive editors, English majors, and my computer absolutely mad, but the story itself, along with the errors, have been transcribed exactly as it was written those many years ago. So here it is, my Hermann Göring Day special, Death in Llewellyn, or The President's Virginia Ham, being a short story written by Shelley Harrell. There is no man whom I shall dislike as much as I disliked Llewellyn at the end of less than 3 weeks. To begin with, there was his name. A normal man would have started his name with a capital L, but no, he insisted it was not proper to use a capital in his name. The double letters served the same purpose. His name, then, should be Lloyd Llewellyn, with no capitals. Llewellyn was the last of his party we had to gather, or last of his party we had to gather before heading into Indian Territory. Picture our surprise when we found that he had three pack animals fully loaded with his personal effects. He had been told that we had to travel as light as we could, that there was to be taken nothing but what we needed most. What is more, he was dressed as if he were going for a few hours' ride near the town. Red jacket, gray trousers, and jack boots have no place in the backwoods. This I told him. "Sir," he answered, "I was told to make ready for a journey into the backwoods, and I consider myself properly attired and my equipment scarcely adequate. If you would think that there is so much as one item that you would have me leave, the item remains here, and so do I." His statement rang with finality. At any other time, had I been spoken to so, the man would have been left standing where he was, but here before us was the only surveyor to be found, and we are in dire need of a surveyor. Llewellyn was unaware that the best way to get into Indian territory unmolested was with such a party as this, and the longer that he did not know the true nature of our trip, the safer we should all be. I controlled my temper and told him to follow us. After all, there might be some chance of his equipment being lost. I let the guide take the lead when I dropped back to talk with this strange person in the red coat. Llewellyn, in a day or so, the roads become so narrow that one can scarcely lead a pack animal, much less ride a horse. That, sir, is a misconception. A man can ride a horse anywhere he can walk. Your horsemanship must be poor. He filled his pipe and began to smoke. How long have you been riding? All my life, I answered in sharp protest. Your pardon, sir. Are you the only one of the group using an army saddle? I thought you might have only learned to ride while you were in the service. If the general had only sent me a surveyor along with my orders, all would have been much better, but no. This tall man who called himself Llewellyn was the only one of the trade to be found. A man from West Point, or even an enlisted man, would know how to respond to discipline and how to show proper respect. But at the end of his brief encounter, I would tell that Llewellyn was the type that would do as he pleased, no matter what happened. It was up to me as leader of the party to see that his behavior did not endanger the lives of the rest of us or the purpose of the journey. The point should include a course on how to deal with civilians. That afternoon, while I was pondering the best way to handle the situation, Llewellyn rode to the head of the column and halted it. Giving no explanation for his actions, he began a fire. One must keep one's strength with a cup of tea and a bit to eat, you know, he said to answer my questions. I assured him that I was in command and that we would not spend our time thus. He informed me that the better we felt, the more distance we should be able to travel, and that if I had a mind to venture on, I was at liberty to do so. He would overtake me before long. Nothing I could do would change his mind. Your orders go well with these other lads, but please, he offered me a place by the side of the fire. Llewellyn, if we were just going on a surveying party, I should be the last to make objections to resting like this. In another day or so, we will be in dangerous territory. Being lax for even a moment might cost us our lives. It is for your safety and for the safety of the group that I tell you that when we stop, it must only be at my order. He agreed to that, and then he promptly argued me into stopping for tea at the proper time each day. His line of reasoning was most simple. I had made the trip before and knew the average distance that would be covered. At the end of 2 days of stopping for tea, we had not covered more than the average distance. Tea would no longer be the order of the day. The best way to win an argument is to let the other fellow prove himself that he's wrong. The next afternoon at tea, I observed Llewellyn scrutinizing the homemade boots of one of the men. Ever see boots like these before, I asked?
No.
What do you think of them? The tanning is poor, and the workmanship could be called good only by a savage. My leather goods from H. Sleep of London, of course. But these men could not afford such prices, I mused. Then they're not very thrifty. I've had this pair of boots for 10 years, and they're still in good condition. These are military boots, are they not? I asked. Yes, I got them when I went to serve in India. I hate to say this, but he turned out to be right after about having tea. When we would stop, he would take from one of the small packs a small tin which had the words Twining, South Strand, London on its side. Then, as he waited for the water to boil, he would start to fill his pipe. The pipe was a Barling of the Tobacco Foursquare, you may be sure. And he went to tell the wonders of India. All remarks were made to no person in general, and he never looked to see whether or not any of us listened to what he said. It was as if he was talking to himself. Most likely he was. Soon after the first of such soliloquies, to be exact, there was only Joe, the Indian guide, to listen to his stories. Joe would listen with undivided attention to stories of strange forests in which a man would not dare to dismount for fear of being attacked by a wild boar. Of odd little men who inflicted punishment on themselves with the hope of some sort of spiritual reward, of great cities with spacious temples and grand palaces. But the other six of us concluded Llewellyn would read more than was good for him. In another day or so, we were forced to walk our horses, as I had told Llewellyn that we should. However, Llewellyn never dismounted. As an act of friendship, Joe started to demonstrate the fine art of marksmanship with his bow. Llewellyn watched coolly before remarking that the man's aim was poor, and the weapon he used was even more primitive than the homemade boots the others wore. No Welshman had ever used such a weapon since before history began. Those remarks left the man with none friendly to him. I deemed it my duty to tell the men the truth as to why we had gone so far in the wilderness, so the next morning I told the men that we had been sent there by the government to make maps of the country. More important than that, we had to make some sort of peace with a certain tribe of Indians which threatened our outposts. Indians held mad persons as being harmless, and they considered surveyors as being mad. That was the reason for our passing as a surveying party. Now that we were in the heart of the Indian country, we should have to be more careful than all that we did. The watch at night would have to be changed twice as often so that the person up would be absolutely alert. What cooking there was would only have been done in the days, so there would be no light from a fire. Only Joe would build the fires, for he knew best how to build one that would not smoke. We should have to change camp often. It would be best if we were to contact the Indians in daylight away from their camp and ours. This way it would not look as if we came looking for them. Under my directions, Llewellyn set up his instruments and began to take measurements along the bank of the river. Even as I could not but marvel at the way each piece of equipment was packed firmly in its own box. I had seen nothing like this before. On each box and on each instrument was the mark of C. Baker of London. The results that Llewellyn got with his equipment were excellent. They were far too good indeed. He charted each tree, each little bend in the river, and every rise and fall in the land. Whatever else I might think of him, I had to admire his care and exactness. But at the rate at which he worked, it would take years to chart the land. For 3 days I let him work much as he pleased. Other than our party, there was no sign of life. Joe told me that only the presence of other men, of men other than ourselves, would cause the wildlife to be so sparse. I again alerted the men at all times they were to be ready to repel an attack. At no time were they to be the first to fire at any Indians they saw, for we had the sanction of being surveyors. That very night, we were captured by Indians. When they found that we were on their land, the Indian sent several parties out to keep an eye on us. While he was on watch, Llewellyn filled his pipe and lit it with a tinderbox. The light was enough to cause us to be spotted by several of our Indian friends, and before the pipe was half smoked, we found ourselves surrounded and all but smothered by our foe. In a short time, their chief came and looked at his captives. A large council fire was built on the spot. We were brought to the edge of the fire. Joe translated the angry chief's words for us. "The white men come playing to draw pictures on the ground. That is not true. There are too many of them," the chief pointed at me. "Captain Green is sent to our land only when we displease white men. I will send him back with a message that the white men must move their cities back, or we shall kill them and burn all their goods. The rest of Captain Green's men will be kept as slaves." He lifted his bronze chest with a breath of air and walked along, looking at each captive in turn. The muscles of his arms quivered with excitement as he observed us. It was obvious that he was looking for an excuse, even a slight one, to make him able to torture us to death. He could not do this purely on the grounds that we were hunting on the land that was joint property with another tribe. That would require calling the other tribe into the matter. I tried to reason with him. My government would not violate the lands this tribe now held if the tribe would not make war on the outposts. He required more than that. The white men must not only move their cities back, but also must pay the tribe for keeping peace. There was an afterthought. The land could be bought for a price more dear than gold. This is what I wanted. Now that he had shown a slight desire for bargaining, there could be a hope of agreement. Both sides would have to give in to some degree, and that, as they had taught us at the point, is as it should be. Could not trading posts be of advantage to us both? No dealings with a cowardly people can be of an advantage to my people. He walked over to Llewellyn. See how your men cower before me. He struck Llewellyn in the face with his fist. Being unprepared for the blow, Llewellyn took it off balance and fell to the ground, spitting blood. This is great sport for the Indians. Nevertheless, Llewellyn found it a sorry sort of a game. Getting to his feet, he walked to the chief. Sir, you are the worst kind of coward. I challenge you to a mortal combat, Joe translated. The chief showed great pleasure in his remark. He could not put us to death for hunting on his land without calling in the chief of the other tribe for a conference, but he could have us killed for attempted murder. We will fight in the morning, the chief said. Then he turned to me. Captain, am I right in thinking that it is the challenged person who has the choice of weapons in a fight of honor such as this? I admitted that he was. In such a case, each of us will have three weapons at his disposal, scalping knife, tomahawk, and bow. The bonds on your arms will be cut. Do not be so foolish as to try to escape. It was not enough that I should have been plagued with Llewellyn these past few days, but now that I could see that his very being would result in the downfall of all of us that I wished to do, the low blow had been struck. My men had always had the highest of respect for me in the past, but now it was clear that they placed full blame on me for Llewellyn's actions. I even blamed myself. There is no reason for letting him be less disciplined than the others, and yet I had. The death of all my party would be my fault. The wrath that the men had, it was in no way back, or held back. Excuse me. As slaves, there would be some hope of escape. As soon as the chief had dispatched Llewellyn, he would see to it that the rest of us would die by slow torture. The dislike of all of us held for the man in the red coat blossomed into full hate. Llewellyn took all of our abuses without a word. As was his habit, he swung a hammock between two trees and promptly went to sleep. Before the first light of dawn could be seen, we were awakened from our feigned sleep and told that it was time for us to be taken to watch the duel. Llewellyn turned in his hammock and announced that he would be left, that he should be left one man to act as his second. His request for Joe was granted. Once more, our hands were tied and we were led to the spot where the fight was to take place. By the edge of the river there was a long, flat piece of ground, some 65 yards wide and over 200 yards long. A post that was no taller than the knee-deep grass marked the center of the field, the end of which the chief now sat awaiting the arrival of his adversary, was marked by a brightly painted skin stretched between two poles. Along the edge of the field, away from the river, were warriors of the tribe. The area was now light enough to see that there were only some were only in loincloths, despite the coolness of the fall morning, and others were in blankets. All wore war paint. Our party was brought to a place behind the drummers, who stood opposite the pole which marked the center of the field. A yell from an unseen brave announced Llewellyn's approach. Llewellyn was flanked by six of the tallest braves I have ever seen. Their figure was so striking that it was some time before I took notice of the Welshman and his second. The former was clad in a blue tunic, white trousers, and black boots. His head was bound in a fantastic way that must have been yards of blue and white cloth, and his hands were wrapped in white gauntlets that came halfway to his elbows. Joe walked behind him and carried a bow longer than by a foot and a half than those I had seen before. Llewellyn adjusted the quiver to the proper position on his back. Joe handed him his bow. Removing the left gauntlet, Llewellyn slid his hand briskly along the bow for a while. The signal for the contest to begin was given. He returned the gauntlet to his left hand and walked with a rapid stride some 20 yards toward the Indian. Holding up his right hand, he yelled to the chief and told him he would not hold it against him if he were to back out of the fight at this point. Joe translated. The chief boasted that he would but wound his opponent so as to be able to torture him to death. From the cuff of his right gauntlet, Llewellyn took his pipe. He lit it and observed the way the wind blew the smoke. He placed the pipe with care at his feet, and after stroking the bow with his left hand, he strung the weapon. Once again he called for the chief to surrender. Once again he was told that he would be tortured. With pleading finality in his voice, Llewellyn made a third try to get the same answer. Swiftly the gauntlets came from his hands and an arrow was fitted across the bowstring. The Indian was at least 140 yards away when Llewellyn released an arrow. Before it had landed, there were two more in the air and a fourth was half out of the quiver. Even the Indians lost sight of the missiles as they cut their path through the sky. One arrow fell a foot short of the chief and a little to the right, but the next two tore through his body as if it had been made of paper. The spectators went wild with excitement, but Llewellyn retrieved his pipe and calmly walked over to cut the leather thongs that bound our hands. We were free. We were saved. An old Indian whose face was like a piece of dry leather came over and examined the Welshman's longbow. He was unable to pull the bow to full draw. He handed the bow to a young brave who had the same trouble. The old Indian made a long talk, and the other Indians cheered madly. Sometime later, I presented the president with the following letter. My dear Mr. President, since the War of 1812, our countries have been at peace with each other. It is my hope that they will remain so. Recently, I became elected chief of a tribe of Indians, which, to that time, was hostile to the United States. I have advised the tribe that the war at this time is not desirable. These men now owe their allegiance to me, and I owe mine to the Crown. Please inform the British ambassador of this situation, which I find most awkward, and have him advise me as to the policy to be followed with and by Her Majesty's latest subjects. Faithfully yours, Big Chief Lloyd Llewellyn, GCGM, Captain, Hodson's Horse, retired. And there you have it. That was from the coin jar, Death and Llewellyn, the President's Virginia Ham. There is another reading from the coin jar, which is going to be following, which is on a separate note over here. As far as this one is concerned, that's it. Happy Hermann Goering Day to you, from all of us to all of you. In the meantime, don't take any nickels. We'll see you out there.